A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one from the middle of a move. He's holed up in a Jerusalem bakery with nothing but his phone, trying to figure out the exact calculus of how many pastries it takes to rent a table for 3 hours without the owner silently wishing you'd evaporate. The core question, how do you master the art of being a long-stay customer without becoming the backpack person everyone resents?
Oh, this is a rich one. And it's not just Daniel's anxiety talking, there's a genuine social contract here that almost nobody has written down. Millions of people are now working from coffee shops as their de facto office, and the etiquette is completely uncodified. You're supposed to just...
Which is exactly what a self-conscious worrier wants to hear. Just feel it out. No, thank you. I want rules. I want a spreadsheet.
That's what we're going to build today. The missing manual. Daniel's in a particularly vulnerable position here. He doesn't even have a laptop to look legitimately busy. He's just a guy on a phone, nursing a pastry, casting nervous glances at the owner.
The phone thing is key. A laptop at least signals I'm working. A phone could mean anything. You could be waiting for a friend who stood you up. You could be hiding from your movers, which, to be fair, he is.
Here's what makes this question bigger than Daniel's specific situation. The sociologist Ray Oldenburg coined the term third place in 1989, spaces that aren't home and aren't work, where community happens. Coffee shops, pubs, barbershops. The problem is, when you bring your work to the third place, you're blurring the categories. You're asking a hospitality business to also be your office.
The business didn't necessarily sign up for that. They signed up to sell you coffee. The fact that they have Wi-Fi and tables doesn't mean they want to be WeWork.
The tension Daniel's feeling. Am I a good customer or am I a squatter? Is the central negotiation of the modern coffee shop economy. And the research on this is actually fascinating. There are barista forums, etiquette guides, even academic papers on the psychology of how long people think they can stay versus how long staff actually want them to stay.
Before we get to the research, though, let's sit with the feeling for a second. Because I think everyone listening knows this exact anxiety. You're on hour two of a single Americano. The pastry is long gone. You need to use the restroom, but you're worried that walking past the counter will trigger a, they're still here? Look from the barista.
The walk of shame, past the counter. I know it well.
There's this internal negotiation. If I order another coffee, that's another $4. But if I don't, am I basically stealing the table? What's the hourly rate on this table? Has anyone done the math?
And we'll get to that. But you've named the core anxiety perfectly. It's not about the money exactly, it's about the ambiguity. If coffee shops just charged by the hour, the transaction would be clear. Instead, you're buying a product and hoping the social permission to occupy space comes bundled with it. But nobody tells you how long the bundle lasts.
A coffee costs $4. A co-working desk costs 20. Somewhere in between is a zone of, I bought a muffin and a latte. Please don't hate me.
That zone shifts depending on the shop, the time of day, how busy it is, what you're doing, how much space you're taking up. It's a multivariate optimization problem for the socially anxious.
Which is why we're going to solve it. Today, the complete guide to being the customer that baristas actually like having around, not the one they post about on Reddit.
Daniel mentioned the backpack. And that's not a random detail. Backpack person is practically a category in coffee shop staff taxonomy. The person who arrives with a bag the size of a carry-on, unpacks a laptop, a second screen, a keyboard, a mouse, a ring light.
A ring light? In a coffee shop?
The research on barista forums consistently flags spreading out as the number one annoyance, above even demanding customers. Taking multiple tables. Using a second chair as a luggage rack. Creating what one Reddit user described as a mobile command center in the corner.
The backpack itself is a signal. It says, I'm here to colonize, not to visit.
Which brings us to the first principle of coffee shop occupancy. Your physical footprint matters as much as your temporal one. The goal is to look like a customer who happens to be working, not a worker who happens to be buying coffee.
That's a great distinction. And it's entirely about perception management. The same person, the same laptop, the same 4-hour stay. But one version looks like they belong and the other looks like they're squatting.
Daniel's in an interesting position because he doesn't have the laptop. In some ways, that makes him less threatening. He's clearly not setting up a satellite office. But in other ways, it makes his presence harder to categorize. What is this man doing here for 2 hours with just a phone?
Looking at memes, probably. That's what I'd be doing.
Which is fine, but it doesn't signal I'm a legitimate customer with a reason to stay. The laptop paradoxically provides cover. It says, I'm productive, I'm not just loitering.
Daniel's anxiety is actually well-founded in one sense. He lacks the standard visual props of the acceptable long-stay customer. He's doing it on hard mode.
He's in Jerusalem, which adds another layer. Israeli coffee culture is its own thing. The expectations around lingering, the pace of service, the tolerance for laptop campers, it's not universal.
Though I'd argue the fundamental dynamics are similar everywhere. A business needs to make money. A table occupied by a slow consumer is a table not occupied by a fast consumer. The math is brutal and simple.
Yet coffee shops tolerate it. Some even encourage it.
Because a busy-looking coffee shop attracts more customers. An empty coffee shop is suspicious. A full one is appealing. So a certain number of laptop people actually serve as free ambiance.
The human scenery argument. There's a whole literature on this in urban sociology. Jane Jacobs talked about eyes on the street, the idea that occupied spaces feel safer and more vibrant. A coffee shop full of people on laptops looks successful, even if half of them are nursing a single cold brew.
We're props. That's comforting.
It is, actually. Your presence has value to the business beyond your receipt total. The question is just how much value, and how to calibrate your behavior so the value equation stays positive.
That's what we're going to map out. The specific mechanisms. The ordering cadence. The peak hours tax. The tipper's rent strategy. The exit choreography. All of it.
I want to flag something before we dive into tactics. Daniel mentioned he's self-conscious and a worrier. And there's a psychological dimension here that's worth naming up front.
The spotlight effect.
Named by psychologists Thomas Gilovich and Kenneth Savitsky in 1999, their research showed that people dramatically overestimate how much others notice them. You think everyone's watching you? They're not. They're thinking about themselves.
Daniel's nervous glances at the owner. The owner probably hasn't even registered his existence beyond guy at table 4. Ordered a pastry.
Baristas are busy. They're making drinks, cleaning, restocking, dealing with actual problems. Monitoring the consumption rate of every customer is not high on their priority list. The real risk isn't being noticed. It's being noticed for the wrong reasons. Taking up excessive space. The basics of being a human in public.
The bar is simultaneously higher and lower than Daniel thinks. Lower because nobody's tracking his pastry-to-minute ratio. Higher because if he does something actually annoying, he'll stand out immediately.
The anxiety is misallocated. He's worried about the invisible metrics when he should be worried about the visible behaviors.
Which is actually a relief. The invisible metrics are unknowable and therefore infinitely stressful. The visible behaviors are controllable.
That's the shift we want to make today. From, am I doing this right? Anxiety to, here's what I can actually control, confidence.
Let's build the manual. Daniel's specific question was about pro tips for finding a space to work without becoming the nuisance backpack person. We're going to answer that comprehensively.
We should acknowledge, Daniel's situation right now is a perfect case study. He's in the middle of a move. He needs to be out of the house. He's working with just a phone. He's in an unfamiliar bakery. He's trying to calibrate in real time. This is the extreme version of the problem.
The I literally cannot go home right now scenario. Which, by the way, is more common than people think. Movers, renovations, pest control, roommate drama, power outages. There are lots of reasons you might need to occupy a commercial space for hours without a clear consumption plan.
The research backs up how widespread this is. A 2023 survey found that 62% of remote workers have worked from a coffee shop in the past month. That's not occasional, that's regular. Millions of people are doing this every day.
Most of them are probably winging it, just like Daniel, operating on vague intuition and hope.
Which is why the etiquette hasn't been codified. Everyone's figuring it out individually. But the patterns are there if you look. The barista forums have a clear consensus on what works and what doesn't. The psychology research explains why we feel the way we feel. The economics explain why shops respond the way they do.
We're going to synthesize all of that into something usable. Not just be considerate. Everyone knows that. Specific, actionable mechanisms.
The ordering cadence. How often to buy something, what to buy, and why spacing matters more than total spend.
The peak hours tax. Why Tuesday at 2 p.m. is a completely different game than Saturday at 10 a.m.
The tip strategy. How a few extra dollars up front can buy hours of goodwill.
The footprint rule. Why your bag on a chair is costing you more social capital than you realize.
The exit strategy. How to leave gracefully so you're welcome back.
Plus location scouting. How to identify a long-stay-friendly shop before you even sit down.
Then we'll zoom out to the bigger question. What happens to third places when everyone treats them as offices? Some shops are already pushing back. Laptop bans during peak hours, time limits, even explicit laptop fees.
The coffee shop in New York's East Village charges a $2 laptop fee during peak hours. That's a market signal. The old implicit contract is becoming explicit.
That might actually be better for everyone. No anxious glances.
Though it does ruin the romance of the third place. Welcome to our community gathering space. Laptops are $2 extra.
The romance was always subsidized by the people buying full meals and leaving quickly. The laptop crowd just exposed the economics.
All right, let's get into the mechanisms. What does the research actually say about how to be the good kind of regular?
The first thing to understand is that Ray Oldenburg's concept of the third place was never supposed to include work. When he wrote The Great Good Place in 1989, the third place was purely social, a pub where everybody knows your name, a barbershop where you argue about sports. The defining feature was conversation.
Now the defining feature is someone on a Zoom call saying you're on mute.
And that's the tension. The coffee shop was designed for one kind of occupancy, short, social, revolving, and we've repurposed it for another kind, extended, solitary, stationary. The business model never changed, but the customer behavior did.
Which means Daniel's anxiety isn't just personal neurosis. He's sensing a genuine structural mismatch. The bakery he's in was built for people who stay 40 minutes and leave. He's asking it to be his office for 3 hours. Those are different products.
The bakery didn't price for the office product. They priced for the 40-minute product. So Daniel is, in effect, negotiating an unstated discount on office space, and he knows it.
Hence the nervous glances. He's waiting for the bill to come due. Except, there is no bill. There's just a social judgment he can't see.
Which brings us to the unspoken contract. I think it has 3 layers. Layer 1 is the commercial transaction. You bought something, you're a customer, you have a right to be there. Layer 2 is the time value of the table, how much revenue that square footage would generate under average turnover. Layer 3 is the social performance. Do you look like you belong, or do you look like you're getting away with something?
Because looking like you belong is almost entirely about signaling that you understand the first 2 layers. The customer who orders regularly, tips well, and keeps their stuff contained is signaling, I know how this works, I'm part of the ecosystem. The customer who buys 1 tea and spreads out for 6 hours is signaling, I don't know the rules, or I don't care.
Staff pick up on those signals instantly. There was a thread on the barista subreddit where someone described the perfect regular. Drip coffee, $2 tip, stays 3 hours, orders a pastry at hour 2, leaves the table clean. The top comment was, I would defend this person with my life.
The bar is not high. A pastry and basic decency. And you've earned a barista's undying loyalty.
That's the thing. Most people don't even clear that bar. The same thread had dozens of stories about the single latte for 5 hours customer. The spread across 3 tables. Customer. The takes a phone call on speakerphone. Customer. The bar is low, and people still trip over it.
Daniel, sitting in his bakery with his phone and his 1 pastry, is already doing better than the bottom quartile just by being aware that there's a problem. The self-consciousness is a feature, not a bug.
It really is. The worst customers have no self-consciousness at all. They're the ones who treat the coffee shop like their living room and seem genuinely surprised when anyone objects.
Awareness alone doesn't solve the calibration problem. Daniel's specific question is, how much do I order? And that's where it gets tricky, because the answer is, it depends on about 6 variables.
Which is why most people just guess. And why Daniel's anxiety is so relatable. He's trying to solve an equation with unknown variables in real time while the owner occasionally glances in his direction.
The equation, if we wanted to be absurd about it, is something like value equals purchases plus dip plus ambiance contribution divided by time multiplied by table scarcity. And you're trying to keep that number above some invisible threshold that only the owner knows.
The threshold moves. Tuesday afternoon when the place is empty, the threshold is basically 0. Saturday morning when there's a line out the door, the threshold is order a full meal every 40 minutes or get out.
Part of mastering this is accepting that the rules are contextual. There's no universal one coffee per 90 minutes law. There's just pattern recognition and adaptation.
Which is what we're going to break down next. The specific mechanisms for reading a room, calibrating your consumption, and becoming the kind of regular that staff are actually happy to see. Let's start with the ordering cadence. This is the mechanism that most directly answers Daniel's question. How much? How often? And the consensus from barista forums and etiquette guides is surprisingly consistent. Order something roughly every 60 to 90 minutes.
60 to 90 minutes. That's the window.
That's the window. And here's the key insight. The specific item matters less than the regularity. A single coffee stretched across 4 hours reads as, I am extracting maximum value from minimum spend. Two small items spaced 90 minutes apart reads as, I am a continuing customer.
It's not about the total dollar amount. It's about the rhythm.
Think of it like a heartbeat, a flatline. One purchase, then nothing, signals death. A regular pulse signals life. The staff may not consciously track it, but they feel it. The guy who orders again at hour 2 is still in the game. The guy who's been nursing the same cold latte since 11 a.m. is a ghost they wish would move on.
Which explains why Daniel's one pastry situation feels precarious. He bought something up front, which is good, but if he's been there 2 hours with no follow-up, the pulse has flatlined.
The fix is almost absurdly simple. You don't need to order a full second meal, a bottle of water. A small drip coffee. Anything that refreshes the transaction. The barista subreddit had a perfect case study. A regular who orders a drip coffee, tips $2, stays 3 hours, and at hour, 2 orders a pastry. The barista who posted about this person called them the ideal. Not because they spent a fortune, but because they maintained the rhythm.
A pastry at hour 2. That's a $4 pulse check.
It transforms the entire interaction. The staff see you're still engaged with the business, not just occupying it. Contrast that with the worst customer from the same thread. Single latte, camps for 5 hours, never looks up from the laptop, never orders again. That person spent maybe $6 for 5 hours of real estate. The perfect regular spent maybe $10 for 3 hours and left a clean table. The total spend isn't wildly different, but the experience of hosting them is night and day.
The rule of thumb is, every time you use the restroom, consider ordering something on the way back. It's a natural interval. You're already up. You're already walking past the counter, and it resets the clock.
That's exactly the heuristic. The restroom trip is your built-in cadence reminder. And it solves the awkwardness problem. You're not making a special trip to the counter just to prove you're still spending. You're already passing by. It looks natural.
Which matters, because one of the things Daniel's anxiety is picking up on is the performance aspect. You don't want to look like you're anxiously buying things to appease the staff. You want to look like a normal person who happens to want a cookie at 3 p.m.
3 p.m. is actually the perfect example, because it brings us to the second mechanism, the peak hours tax. This is the variable that most people completely ignore, and it's arguably more important than how much you spend.
Explain the tax.
The key variable isn't how long you stay, it's when you stay. Tuesday from 2 to 5 p.m. is fundamentally different from Saturday from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. The research on coffee shop traffic patterns shows that peak hours cluster in 2 windows, roughly 7 to 9 a.m. for the morning rush and 11,030 a.m. to 1,030 p.m. for lunch. During those windows, the expectation is turnover. The business is losing real money if you're camping.
Because during peak hours, that table could have turned over 2 or 3 times.
A foretop during Saturday brunch that's occupied by one person with a laptop and an empty cup. That's not just annoying, it's economically damaging. The owner is watching potential groups of 4 walk in, see no tables, and leave. Your $10 tab just cost them $60 in lost revenue.
The calculus completely flips. During peak hours, even the perfect ordering cadence might not be enough.
During peak, the expectation shifts from maintain a buying rhythm to don't overstay. An hour might be pushing it. During off-peak, say 2 to 5 p.m. on a weekday, the dynamic inverts. The shop is empty. Staff are restocking, cleaning, killing time. A quiet, predictable regular who orders something every 90 minutes and doesn't cause problems is actually preferable to an empty seat.
Because an empty shop feels dead.
A dead shop repels customers. There's a reason restaurants seat people near the window first. Occupied space signals viability. During off-peak, your presence is free marketing. You're not costing them a table. You're providing ambiance they couldn't otherwise buy.
Daniel, sitting in a bakery on a weekday, is probably in an off-peak window. His presence is net neutral or even slightly positive, assuming he's ordered something recently.
That's the context he should use to calibrate his anxiety. If there's a line out the door and he's been there 2 hours on a single pastry, okay, the anxiety is warranted. If the place is half empty and he's ordered twice in 3 hours, he's probably the owner's favorite customer of the day.
Which brings us to the third mechanism, and this one I love because it's so concrete. The tip as rent.
This is maybe the most actionable single tactic in the entire playbook. Multiple etiquette sources, and I'm talking professional etiquette consultants, not just Reddit, recommend a generous tip on your first order as a way to essentially prepay goodwill for your stay. The consensus is 20 to 25%, or a flat $1 to $2 per drink if you're in a counter service situation. The key is that it's on the first order. You're signaling upfront, I understand I'm going to be here a while. Here's compensation for the real estate.
It's not a tip for service, it's rent.
It's rent. And it's remarkably cheap rent. $2 for 3 hours of table space. That's 67 cents an hour. Compare that to a co-working space at $20 a day. The tip as rent strategy is the most cost-effective office lease in the modern economy.
It transforms the psychology of the interaction. The staff see a generous tip up front, and suddenly your extended stay is pre-authorized. You've paid the cover charge. You're not a squatter. You're a patron who tipped well and is now enjoying the space they paid for.
There's actual behavioral economics behind this. The concept of reciprocity, if you do something generous first, people feel a subtle obligation to be generous back. In this case, the generosity back is simply tolerance. They'll let you stay longer without resentment because you've already demonstrated that you value the space.
I'm imagining Daniel, mid-move, sliding a generous tip across the counter and then settling in with his phone. The owner's internal monologue shifts from, who is this guy, to this guy gets it.
That's the whole game. The difference between being resented and being welcomed is often just a few dollars and some awareness of timing. The final mechanism I want to hit in this section is the backpack visibility problem, because this is where even well-intentioned customers fail.
Daniel specifically mentioned the backpack.
And the research backs up his instinct. Across barista forums, etiquette guides, and even some academic work on retail psychology, spreading out is consistently flagged as the number one staff annoyance. Taking up excessive physical space reads as entitlement.
What counts as spreading out?
The rule of thumb is, keep your belongings to the footprint of a single place setting. No second chair for your bag, no laptop stand that towers over the counter, no jacket draped across the table next to you, no charging cable snaking across the floor to a distant outlet. The goal is to look like a customer who happens to be working, not a worker who happens to be buying coffee.
That distinction again. It really is the organizing principle.
It really is. And it manifests physically. A laptop on the table, fine. A laptop plus an external keyboard, plus a mouse, plus a tablet, plus a notebook, plus a water bottle, plus a bag on the adjacent chair. You've built a camp. You're no longer a customer. You're a settler.
The mobile command center you mentioned earlier.
Here's where it gets interesting. The market is starting to push back. Some shops are done with the ambiguity entirely. The coffee shop in New York's East Village implemented a $2 laptop fee during peak hours. not a subtle hint. An actual line item on your receipt.
Which is basically saying, we see what you're doing and we're monetizing it.
They're not alone. Cafes in London, Berlin, Seoul, there's a growing trend of explicit laptop policies. Some ban them outright during weekend brunch. Some charge an hourly workspace fee that includes a coffee. Some have designated laptop-free zones.
The old implicit contract is being replaced by explicit terms, which, honestly, might be better for everyone.
I think it is. Daniel's anxiety exists because the rules are invisible. If there's a sign that says laptops welcome 2 to 5 p.m., $2 fee during peak hours, the anxiety evaporates. You know exactly where you stand.
The shops that resist this, the ones that keep it implicit, are essentially outsourcing the emotional labor to the customer. You figure out if you're overstaying. We'll just glare.
Which brings me to the psychological reframe I want to offer Daniel directly. That nervous glance at the owner? The constant scanning for disapproval? The research suggests it's mostly in your head.
The spotlight effect.
Gilovich and Savitsky, 1999. They had students wear embarrassing t-shirts and then estimate how many people noticed. The students consistently overestimated by a factor of 2 or 3. We all think we're the main character, we're not.
The owner isn't tracking Daniel's pastry-to-minute ratio.
The owner is thinking about inventory, staffing, the broken espresso machine, the delivery that's late, the health inspection next week. Baristas are understaffed and overwhelmed. Monitoring one quiet guy on his phone is approximately item number 47 on their priority list.
Unless he does something actually annoying.
That's the crucial distinction. The real risk isn't being noticed. It's being noticed for the wrong reasons. If you're quiet, clean, compact, and you've ordered something recently, you're functionally invisible. The staff's attention goes to the loud table, the spilled drink, the customer complaining about the temperature.
Daniel's anxiety is misallocated. He's worrying about the invisible metrics when the visible behaviors are what actually matter.
Here's the liberating corollary. If you're self-conscious enough to worry about being a nuisance, you're almost certainly not one. The actual nuisances have no self-consciousness. They're the ones on speakerphone, spreading across 3 tables and leaving a mess. They don't wonder if they're the problem. They're not capable of wondering that.
The fact that Daniel is anxious is evidence that he's fine.
It really is. The anxiety is the proof of conscientiousness. But I want to give him something more concrete than, don't worry. There's a skill here that most people overlook, knowing when to leave.
The exit strategy.
Part of mastering the long stay is recognizing the signals that your welcome is expiring. The research identifies 3 clear ones. First, the shop empties out and you're the only customer. That's uncomfortable for everyone. Second, staff start cleaning around you, sweeping near your table, stacking chairs on nearby tables. That's not subtle.
That's the universal language of, please go home.
Third, you've crossed the 3-hour mark without a new order. Even in the most tolerant shop, 3 hours is pushing it. The graceful exit involves one final purchase, even just a bottle of water, and a verbal thank you to the staff on your way out.
The exit purchase. That's clever. It turns your departure from an awkward escape into a final transaction. You're not fleeing. You're just a customer who bought something and is now leaving.
It leaves a positive last impression. The staff's final memory of you is polite person who said thank you and bought a water. That's the memory that carries over to your next visit.
Which matters because the meta skill underneath all of this is location scouting. You need to pick the right shop before you even sit down.
The research identifies 4 indicators of a long-stay-friendly shop. 1. Presence of power outlets. If they've installed outlets at every table, they've made a deliberate choice to accommodate laptop users. 2. Free Wi-Fi with no time limit and no purchase code that expires. If the Wi-Fi password changes daily and you have to ask for it, that's a friction signal. A community board or bookshelf. It signals a relaxed, lingering, is-welcome vibe. 4. Staff who are chatting with regulars. If the barista knows customers by name and stops to talk, that's a culture of lingering. That shop wants you to stay.
The chain versus independent distinction matters here.
A Starbucks in a business district is practically designed for laptop campers. Standardized policies, no owner glaring at you, high tolerance by corporate design. A small independent roastery in a residential neighborhood is a completely different animal. They might have 4 tables and a business model built on quick turnover and conversation. Same behavior, completely different reception.
Before Daniel settles into a bakery mid-move, he should scan for outlets, check the Wi-Fi situation, look for a bookshelf, and watch how the staff interact with other customers.
If two of those four indicators are missing, find another spot. It's not worth the anxiety.
Which loops back to his current situation. He's in an unfamiliar bakery, on his phone, mid-move, no laptop. He's doing this on hard mode, but the principles still apply. Keep the footprint small. Order something every 90 minutes. Tip well up front. Watch for the exit signals.
Remember that the owner probably hasn't even noticed him.
Given all that, the mechanisms, the psychology, the shifting landscape, what can you actually do starting tomorrow? Let's boil it down to four rules that cover most situations.
Rule 1, the one-in-one. Order one item immediately upon arrival, tip generously, 20% minimum, and order a second item roughly halfway through your stay. That's it. Two purchases, spaced out. You're not a squatter, you're a continuing customer.
The halfway point is flexible. 90 minutes, 2 hours. The rhythm matters more than the precision.
Rule 2, the 90-minute check. Set a quiet timer on your phone. When it goes off, three questions. Have I ordered something recently? Am I still in off-peak hours? Have I spread out? If any answer is no, adjust or leave.
I'd add a fourth question. Has the owner started pointedly sweeping near my feet?
That's covered under adjust or leave. Rule 3, the exit package. Always have a small cheap item in mind, bottled water, a cookie, a bag of beans if you want to go big. Order it on your way out. It turns your departure from an awkward escape into a graceful final transaction. The staff's last memory of you is polite person who bought something and said thank you.
If you're really playing the long game, make the exit purchase something you can plausibly need. Grabbing a water for the road sounds natural. I would like to purchase one additional cookie to atone for my extended presence, does not.
Rule 4, location vetting. Before you settle in, scan for the four indicators. Power outlets, Wi-Fi policy, community vibe, that's the bookshelf or bulletin board, and staff chatting with regulars. If two are missing, find another spot.
If you walk in and see a sign that says, no laptops after 11 a.m., don't try to negotiate. That shop has made its choice. Respect it and move on.
Those four rules will get you through about 90% of situations. The remaining 10% are edge cases. The shop that's weirdly hostile despite all indicators, the unexpected rush that fills every table, the barista who's just having a bad day.
For those, there's the fifth unofficial rule. Read the room and trust your gut. If it feels wrong, it probably is. Pack up, buy your exit water, and try the place two blocks over.
Daniel, if you're still in that bakery, you're fine. The fact that you're thinking about this at all puts you in the top quartile of customers. The owner's probably just glad you're not the guy with the ring light. There's a bigger question lurking here, and I think it's the one Daniel's situation points toward. As more shops adopt explicit laptop policies and time limits, what actually happens to the third place? If the coffee shop becomes a paid workspace, is it still a third place at all?
That's the tension Oldenburg probably saw coming. The third place requires a certain looseness. You're not a customer, you're not an employee, you're just... The moment there's a laptop surcharge on your receipt, the category collapses. You're a client renting a desk.
Maybe that's fine. Maybe the third place was always a romantic idea that worked better in 1989, before remote work and smartphones. The pub where everybody knows your name still exists, but it's not where you go to clear your inbox.
Daniel's situation is actually a perfect microcosm of where this is heading. He's in Jerusalem, mid-move, no laptop, just a phone. He's not even trying to be productive in the traditional sense. He's just trying to exist somewhere that isn't his chaotic apartment for a few hours. And the infrastructure for that, the social infrastructure, the etiquette, the business models, hasn't caught up.
The anywhere office is becoming the norm, but we're still operating on assumptions from the era when working meant going to a building designated for work. Daniel's phone-only setup is almost a preview of the next phase, when you don't even need a laptop to work remotely, just a screen and a connection. The coffee shop becomes a kind of ambient productivity tank.
I could see a future where cafes get certified for different use cases. Remote work-friendly becomes a badge, like Michelin Star, but for outlets and tolerance, bronze, Wi-Fi, and power, silver, designated quiet hours. gold, soundproof call booths, and has stated no glaring policy.
It sounds absurd, but it's already happening in pieces. WeWork tried to blur the line from the other direction, co-working spaces with baristas. The coffee shop and the office are converging from both sides. Eventually, the distinction might disappear entirely.
In the meantime, Daniel's in a bakery with his phone, trying to solve a social equation that nobody's written down, which is exactly the kind of thing this show exists for.
The unspoken rules of modern life. If you have a weird prompt about some invisible social contract you're trying to navigate, send it to us. Email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Our producer is Hilbert Flumingtop. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. We'll catch you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from law. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.